Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is a very energetic lady called Y. Shorley, and she is an acclaimed writer. She articulates insights into beyond the power of positive thinking and is a national speaker. And she overcame a near-paralyzing life-threatening disease, the loss of the beloved mother figure who was murdered at the age of 10, that is when she was 10, and she turned her life around to become a success through her new book, You Are What You Love. Are you there, Y. Shorley?
Mike, would I miss a date with you, darling? Never.
Say it again.
I said, of course I'm here. Would I miss a date with you?
Oh.
Never.
Oh, I thought no sooner did you say you were there than you'd gone. That's great. Well, welcome to the program. I'd like to just clear up this attachment you have to the color purple. I visited your website, and it's very attractive with the emphasis on that particular color. And I see that it's also part of the name of your email address. What is your attachment to that?
Purple does seem to be my color drug of choice, doesn't it, Mike?
Yes.
And since I was a small child, I've been fascinated by this color. When I was a small child, though, the fashion world didn't really cater to it, and you couldn't get a lot of clothing or accessories in this color. But as I've gotten older, the fashion community has gotten more enlightened and it's become more and more available, and now that I'm an adult and I can buy whatever I want, I'm totally out of control. But to tell you the truth, there's a couple of things that are interesting about the color purple. In Hinduism, purple is Shiva's favorite color. And
yes.
Shiva is considered to be the most powerful of all the gods, because Shiva was willing to drink the world's poison, its greed,
yeah,
its avarice, its negativity, and transform it into unconditional love. So for me, purple represents that choice of free will to take the worst that life can throw at you and to transform it into unconditional love. And I like to wear that. I like to wear that attitude. I like to wear that state of consciousness. I like to wear that right down to my underwear. I like to wear that.
Yes.
Now, weren't you glad you asked, Mike?
Well, does it also extend to your surroundings in your home?
It does, much to my boyfriend's chagrin. He definitely feels that he gets an over-inundation of the color and is constantly asking me to get some level of balance. But I'm fascinated with the color, and my book is an endorsement by Danyon Brinkley, the author of Saved by the Light. And before I had actually physically been in the presence of Danyon and met him, we talked on the phone considerably. And he said, you know, when I look at you energetically, when we talk on the phone and I see your energy body,
yeah,
he said, you don't even really exist in the way we think of individual consciousness as existing. He said, when I look at you, I see something I've never seen before. He said, when I look at you, he said, do you know who the Violet Flame group is? And I said, Saint Germain, the Violet Flame? Yeah, that's exactly what I said, Mike. I said, yes, I'm familiar with them.
Indeed,
yes. He said, when I look at you, what I see is a Violet Flame group. It's as if you do not even exist, and they download straight through you, which would probably explain the fascination for this color since I was a small child.
Yes, yes. So is it part of your auric colors as well?
There are many people, Mike, who are that way, who see one's auric spectrum, who have told me that there is a tremendous amount of purple that hovers around me incessantly.
Yes.
But if you were to see me, you would know that purple is wildly excited about getting into my life.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised that purple is within your own aura. I don't know whether it's a delicate point or one you don't like to refer to in detail, but I believe having mentioned about your childhood and the difficulties that you overcame, would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
I don't mind talking about that. That's, you know, another lifetime ago. And
yeah,
it did bring brought me a great deal of sensitivity. When I was born, Mike, I was born with a birth defect on my face that made socializing with children very painful and very challenging. I remember getting stoned a lot at school. And, I mean, literally, they would pick up rocks and throw them at me. And because when you physically look different, kids are not real warm and fuzzy in how they greet you. And I had a lot of cosmetic surgery on this birth defect, but as you know, when you're a child, your muscles, your skeletal structure is still changing, and so it was still apparent until I was probably late 18, 19, 20, and I grew up in a small town, so once kids see you in a certain light, they never let you grow out of it.
No, no.
And,
they can be rather cruel, can't they?
They can corner the market on cruelty.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. Before we really get into matters relating to your book, I noticed that you have actually been on Oprah and Friends. What was that like for you? Did you take an active part in it with the audience?
This was on Dr. Oz Emmett's Mehmet show. Dr. Oz Mehmet is Oprah's doctor, and this is on satellite radio. So there wasn't a live audience. There were not collective bags of protoplasm with which to interact in that way.
Yes. But did you have a phone-in audience?
No. It's just sometimes Dr. Oz's wife, Lisa, sits in on the shows, and sometimes she doesn't, but the particular interview that I did, she did happen to be present. So it was Dr. Oz and his wife and myself.
I see, right, yes. Now, you obviously have an interest in the law of attraction. You question whether people really understand it. Would you like to explain yourself on that?
Yes. You know, Mike, this actually goes back to the title of my book. You are what you love. And that's a spiritual law, but it's only half of the equation. Here's the whole equation. You are what you love, and you love whatever you're giving your attention to right now. And what this comes down to is that our awareness, our consciousness, is our divinity. It's inseparable from our divinity. So when you're giving your awareness to something, you're giving something at your attention, you're giving it your love, you're giving it your divinity. And that means that if you go through your day and you find that numerous times out of the day, you're giving your attention to an inner dialogue that rambles on something like this. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough money. This isn't going to work out for me. Why am I so stupid and I can't seem to get this right? Nobody is going to love me. I'm going to get in the slow lane on the freeway. I'm going to get in the slow lane at the grocery store. I'm going to get home and there's going to be a bill I can't pay yet again. If your mind, in other words, is constantly rambling off to a dialogue that looks limiting, sounds limiting, feels limiting, because of the law, you are what you love, and you love whatever you give your attention to, you love living in an environment of scarcity and lack and unhappiness. And people aren't making this gestalt, they're not making this connection that their awareness is love, and love is the most powerful force in the universe. So when you give something your attention, you are giving it your love, whether you like it or not, whether it's something you want to attract more of or not, because love is the most powerful force in the universe. When you give something your attention, you're giving it your love, therefore you're drawing it into the whole of your life.
Yes. So just extending that a little bit, where does fear fit into that?
Fear, it's, if I could draw an equation, a visual equation for us. I know there are many people out there that don't feel that they're good at math, but don't worry, this is a non-challenging equation. You'll get this one.
Yeah.
When you give your attention to something that is unlimiting, like, for example, I don't have love. Love is not a possession. Nobody can take it away from me. I can go through divorce court. I can go on a bad date. I can have a bad hair day. My butt can get so big it's creating its own gravitational force field. And that doesn't change the fact that I don't have love. I am love. Yeah. Now, fear is the flip side of that equation. Fear is giving your attention to something limiting. So love, attention to something unlimited equals love or higher love. Attention to something limiting equals fear.
Yes. I had in mind then that people often fear illness because sometimes for hereditary reasons it runs in families. And of course they know their own family background and they grow up fearing that they're going to end up the same as other members of the family. So presumably what you have to do is to take your focus off that.
Absolutely, sweetheart. And one of the bigger pictures in spirituality that is essential to remember and to respect is that all of us have free will. Free will reigns on this planet. All of us ultimately decide what we're going to give our attention to and how we're going to feel about what we give our attention to. Now, Mike, I'm not saying that the media isn't going to vie for your attention, isn't going to suggest that you don't funnel your attention this way or that way. Of course they're going to. But ultimately, you decide what you give your attention to and what charge it is that you bring to what you give your attention to. Every member of the family has free will. And what's important to do is to stand back and say, the members of my family, for whatever reason, have chosen with their free will to buy into this line of propaganda, to buy into this party line. Maybe they felt they had no choice. Maybe they looked around them and they saw it modeled by other family members and simply didn't know any better than to simply invest into it as the ultimate end of their destiny. But I have free will. And if I choose not to buy into the same internal ethereal real estate that my family has bought into, I can choose a different story. I can choose a different path. I can choose a different self-definition and different relationship with reality.
Yes. In that event, do you believe in reincarnation?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. God consciousness, love consciousness is, if nothing else, Mike, it is profoundly creative. It is profoundly inventive in ways that it creates opportunities to experience itself, to explore, learning about its value, its power, its worth. It seems incredibly myopic and limited to me to think that God consciousness is only creative of incarnating one bag of protoplasm one time and that's it.
Well, what was crossing my mind then was that karma goes in hand with reincarnation, and I was wondering if someone chose to experience a particular type of illness, or for whatever reason that may be, could they still put that aside by not focusing on it, or would that be inevitable because it was part of their plan?
That's a really good question, and I have a very different definition of karma that I talk about in my book. And a lot of people think of karma as a debt you have to pay, which I kind of like to shy away from because I don't think that ultimately that's the most useful in us understanding the highest principles of karma. And some people consider it the law of cause and effect. And I don't have a problem with that, but I kind of like to even grow beyond the cause and effect definition. And this is how I talk about karma. And I know it seems like I'm being circuitous. Am I answering the question about disease? But I'll get there. So karma, the way that I talk about it in the book, is an incomplete action. We came here to learn about our divinity. and to learn that we do not have love. We are it, and no one and no thing on this planet has the power to change that. And as divine love, that also means we do not have value and power and worth. I don't have to earn it. It's not a question of deserving and worthy. I don't have to wait till my family or community throws a few crumbs at me and says, take two, they're small. I don't have value, power, and worth. I am it. Because when was love ever separate from value, power, and worth? So we come here to learn that unconditionally. That's why the earth is only made up of conditions. Because it's constantly throwing another condition at you to say, can you do it now? Can you be love now? Can you be love now? Can you be love now? And as you're practicing being with it, at every condition that is thrown at you, you gain unconditional mastery of your divinity. So when an experience touches your nervous system and your life, and you respond to it with correct identification of your divinity, that is a complete action. That is beyond karma. That means that there will be no other action that will come from this learning experience because the action is complete. But when something comes to you, you get diagnosed with cancer, you get diagnosed with lupus, you get diagnosed with whatever it is that is heavily charged and often comes with painful circumstances and packaged in potential extraordinary suffering for you and your family. If you identify with that state of limitation, if you identify with being the doctor's diagnosis, if you identify with being a state of terminal, if you identify with being damaged and defective, then you know what? You've got an incomplete action on your hand. That's an incomplete action, so you are destined to repeat that lesson until you complete the action.
Yeah.
So if you agreed, Mike, to take on a disease in this lifetime because it brings you a lesson that you wanted in your unconditional mastery of your divinity, if you stood up to the plate right away and resolved that action and made it complete, you would move on and you would be done with it.
Yeah, that's very interesting to hear your views on that. Now, you mention somewhere, I think, in your book or in your interests that religion has come into your life. How does that, again, fit in with your present views?
That's an interesting question, darling. I'm similar to the Dalai Lama in the respect that I embrace all religions. My favorite mystic is a 18th century scientist mystic named Emanuel Swedenborg. And one of the things that Emanuel Swedenborg says is that there is only one God. There only ever has been one God. So it doesn't matter if you call your God Allah, Buddha, Shiva, Jesus, Buddha consciousness, the eternal void, Tao consciousness. Doesn't matter what you call it. Doesn't matter if you do a puja, a rosary. Get on bended knee or stand up with exalted hands. We're all worshiping the one God. And every religion has something to offer. Yeah. And I like to think of religions, all the different world's religions. Imagine, Mike, a wheel. And every different one of the world's religions is a spoke on that wheel. They're all taking us to the center. They're all taking us to the one God. So what I appreciate about religion is if we can get over religion being a competitive contest, I'm going to prove to you that my God is better looking than your God. You know what I mean? If we can let go of this competitiveness about religion and just show up and ask each other honestly, how is it that you touch the face of the living God with the way that you practice recognizing your divinity? How do you make yourself available for allowing the phenomena of letting your ego go and letting God move through to create whatever is the potential of your vessel, of your life? If we allow ourselves to stand back and see each one as a poem, as a love song, if we allow ourselves to stand back and instead of hearing one lone voice in the wilderness, if we allow ourselves to see each one of these religions as a member of a choir and stand back and be willing to hear the harmonized voice of the entire choir, that, I feel, is being in right relationship with the world's religions.
Yes, yes, indeed. You mentioned that Swedenborg was an immense help to you.
Yeah.
Could you expand upon what you said a little bit earlier, where you quoted him?
I would adore this, because Mike, Emanuel Swedenborg, quite frankly, is one of my favorite subjects to talk about. And
right.
He lived from 1688 to 1772.
Yeah.
And even though he died in 1772, Mike, I like to call him my boyfriend.
Right.
And you know that joke that they have about men, that men have a girl in every port?
Yes.
My favorite joke is, I have a man in every dimension.
I like that.
And Swedenborg is my boyfriend on the other side. But this is a guy, Mike, that very few people have heard about. And he influenced some of the most profound minds in Western civilization. He highly influenced Immanuel Kant, although Immanuel Kant never really quite reconciled himself with Emanuel Swedenborg. He was highly influenced by him. He highly influenced Carl Jung, Ralph Waldo Emerson, D.T. Suzuki, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, William Blake, Helen Keller. There's so many people that his wisdom left fingerprints in their psyche. And we know of all these other people, but very few people have heard of Swedenborg. And if you go to the Guinness Book of World Records, he's in there for one of the largest IQs.
Yeah.
Stanford University, a few years ago, wanted to come up with a list of the top 10 most brilliant people who ever lived. And my boyfriend, Emanuel Swedenborg, and two other people tied for first place.
Right.
He mastered every known science in his life. He wrote 4 volumes on the human brain, came up with what the pituitary gland is for, the endocrine system. He figured out the relationship between respiration and the nervous system, the movement of cerebral spinal fluid up the back of the spine.
Right.
He wrote 150 scientific works, came up with the first working hanging glider, came up with the first blueprint for a submarine. He was a metallurgist. He was a member of Sweden's parliament. I mean, I could spend the rest of the show just rattling off his scientific achievements. But this is what impressed me about him, Michael. He said that he'd been able to control his breathing and enter into a trance-like state since he was a very small child, which is probably how he did all his scientific adventures, was being able to control his breathing and concentrate his focus. And he said when he was 56 years old, he happened to be traveling in England. He was in London, which, by the way, next to Oscar Wilde, London was also Emanuel Swedenborg's favorite party town, and I'm not one to argue with Oscar Wilde or Emanuel Swedenborg, so totally rock on there, dude.
Wrong.
So, at any rate, he's in London, he's traveling, and he's going into one of these meditative, control-your-breathing, trance-like states, and he said he was able to break through into the spiritual realm. And the veil between the physical and spiritual world broke down. And he said that it was revealed to him that all of his early life training as a scientist was for one sole purpose. And that was for him, once these veils dissolved, was he was to travel to the spiritual realm and write about the various levels of higher order spiritual organization and lower order spiritual realization, to write about them. And he wrote over 35 volumes of work. He wrote over 3.5 million words. And he says that there are 3 levels of heaven, celestial, spiritual, natural, and then there's the middle world, and we live in the middle world, and there are 3 levels of hell. Now, you got to remember, this is in the 18th century. He's born the son of a Lutheran bishop. They're not talking about different levels of hell, heaven and hell. This is,
right.
It's outrageous from their perspective.
Oh,
now,
yes,
if you go to Buddhism, if you go to Taoism, well, they've known that there are levels of heaven and hell for a long time.
Yes.
This was new to the Western world. So Swedenborg was told that his purpose was to write about the spiritual realm and use the same dispassionate, neutral powers of observation he has cultivated as a scientist in describing the spiritual realm.
Yes.
Which, to take, for example, Mike, if this job was given to me, I might write about all the people that aren't wearing purple and how ridiculous that is, because I'm kind of biased by my non-neutral level developed sense of perception.
Right.
But he had a very scientific, just the facts, ma'am, ability to write about these things. So he was revolutionary, and that's one of the things that he came out and he said is this. He said, when you die, we've all been taught that there's a judgment day. And he said, well, in a way that's right, in a way it's not what you think it is. And he said, the first thing that he wants everyone to know is this. God is incapable of judging you. Incapable of it. Because God is pure, unconditional love and nothing else.
Yeah.
So he says, God is incapable of getting angry at you. God is incapable of judging you. He said, God is even incapable of even remotely frowning in your direction. Incapable of it. He said, when you cross over, regardless of how you lived your life, what your political platform is, whether you ate white flour and white sugar or not, whether you watched soap operas or molested children, doesn't matter. Everybody goes immediately to the absolute highest level of heaven without judgment. Here's the really interesting part. Are you ready for this, Mike? Do you have your spiritual seatbelt fastened?
Right.
Here's a really interesting part.
Yeah.
He says we don't all stay there. And he says that when we leave, those of us who leave, aren't leaving because they're being judged and they're told that they have to leave. They're not leaving because there's an angel with a clipboard that shows up that says, look, I am so sorry, but there was a terrible mistake made, and you really belong in a lower level. That's not why. He says, this is why. You are what you love, and you love whatever you're giving your attention to. And if you have practiced while you had a body on the earth, giving your attention to, let's say, worry, self-criticism, always waiting for the other shoe to drop, looking over your shoulder because you're going to get them before they get you. When you arrive in heaven, there's nothing to worry about. Nobody's criticizing anybody. Nobody's out to get anybody. If you haven't practiced that level of self-acceptance, of peace, of love and understanding and compassion for your brothers and sisters, you're not going to be comfortable there, and you are going to immediately seek lower ground.
Yeah,
so here's the bottom line. There's a judgment day, but God doesn't judge you. You judge you, and you decide what level of spiritual reality you're comfortable with, and you migrate there. Fascinating,
yes,
isn't it?
I can accept that.
Well, that's the good news, isn't it? Is that my story is that I'm practicing living in the highest level of heaven now, and I don't have love. I am love. You can do your best. You can throw your best at me. I'm not leaving this higher level of heaven. And the earth is the ultimate laboratory for practicing that. It's the ultimate practice ground. Because when we go to the other side, we don't have a nervous system over there. That comes with the bag of protoplasm.
Yes.
So when you have a bag of protoplasm, when you're giving your attention to something limiting or fearful, your nervous system immediately registers that and it gives you feedback, a feeling feedback. Maybe your jaw gets tight. Maybe your gut gets tight. Maybe you get an ulcer. Maybe your shoulders are hunched up around your ears. Maybe you're running, I don't have enough money, and your wallet and your bank account are getting tight and getting constricted. But the bottom line is that the planet Earth offers you an immediate form of feeling feedback that keeps you real about what are you doing with your love. And we don't get that on the other side. You don't feel that with the kind of immediacy that you do when you have a nervous system here. Because everything on the planet Earth is designed for one reason, Mike, and that's this: to keep you real and honest about what you're doing with your love. Yeah. Because you are what you love. And you love whatever you're giving your attention
okay.
to.
Why, surely. Now, what I'd like to do is to give out the call-in line numbers for our listeners. I understand they should be open during this program. Then what I'd like you to do when I've given out those numbers is to tell me your understanding of what our life purpose is. So I'll just tell people that there is a line for the US, which is 877-876-5227. I'll repeat it in case you didn't get that down. 877-876-5227. And for Canada, it's 888-815-9756. And I'll repeat that again. 888-815-9756. So, back to you, Y. Shorley. How about life purpose?
That's a really good question. That's a good meaty question, Mike. I'm glad you threw that out on the table. There are individual purposes that people take a life. Some people want to explore something that they have been challenged by in a past life, or they want to explore something that they feel that they have not really had an opportunity to refine. But there's a universal life purpose. There's life purpose that has to relate to every single individual. So there's an individual life purpose, and then there's a universal or collective life purpose. And one of the things that has to do with our collective life purpose is that all of us come here to experience this law. You are what you love, and you love whatever you give your attention to. And all of us collectively have come to answer, who am I? Why am I here? What is the meaning and purpose of my life? What is my value, my power, and worth? We can put all that on the collective universal side. There's nobody that's going to incarnate on the planet that isn't going to have that purpose as part of why they're here. Does that make sense?
Yes, indeed, yes. Yes,
pluck an individual out of the collective and ask them what particular aspect, what particular dimension of their divinity did they want to focus on in this life. And let's take your earlier example, Michael, that you had that was very compelling, and there's a lot of meat on that, is the illness one.
Yes.
People may come here and part of their life purpose is to experience a certain illness. And there could be a myriad of different reasons why they do that.
Yeah.
Let me put this one on the table. A lot of people are very good at giving. Very good at giving. But they're not that good at receiving. Because a lot of us in our mind equate receiving with a certain level of vulnerability. Being defective, needing to receive something because we're not good enough. We couldn't do it ourselves. We'd rather be the one who gives, because that's coming from the place of, I have it all, I'm perfect, I got it, let me help fix you. And receiving implies, I'm the person that needs fixing. So a person may agree as part of their life purpose to take on a certain illness because it forces them out of their giving position. And it forces them into learning something about receiving and being a better receiver. Somebody may choose an illness because in a past life, there was an important key person in their life that was very, very ill. And that illness may have made a lot of demands on the person who was not ill, may have required a lot of their energy, a lot of their understanding. In this particular life, it's time to turn the tables around. It's time to teach the person who was ill how difficult it is to be the caretaker. So they have to caretake you this time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different reasons. There may be a reason you may take on an illness because you've chosen in this life that what you really want to do is activate your inner healer. So you are going through certain illnesses and certain health challenges, maybe once acutely, maybe constantly, consistently, because you want to learn something about what it's like to be in pain. You, in order to help people heal, to help them get on with their lives, you need to understand something about what they're going through.
Yeah.
Maybe you want in your next life to be an energy healer, to be a doctor, to be somebody that comes up with the big cure for something that is really ailing humanity. In this life, you may choose to die of that illness so that you learn everything you need to know about that nature of that illness, what holds it together, how people get it, why they don't let it go, so when you come in the next life, you can knock that puppy out of the ballpark.
I think also there is an aspect here where people might come into a life to experience pain because they have in a previous life inflicted it upon someone else and they need to understand what they've caused.
Absolutely. I could not say that better. You know, I remember working with a woman that's a very powerful intuitive, and we were doing a healing conference. And she was sharing a story about a client of hers. There was a drug that was used in America in the 50s. And I can never say this chemical right, I have a hard problem, whatever it is, that mixture of consonants and vowels is always a hard drug for me to say. But it was a drug that was given to women in America in the 50s for nausea during morning sickness. And what it caused, the birth defect that it caused in the fetus, is that it caused these children to be born, some of them without feet or legs. They were born with flippers. Or some of them were born without arms. They were born with flippers.
Yeah.
And she was telling me about a healing session she was doing with a young man who had legs but no feet. He had flippers. So he had to be committed to a wheelchair his entire life. And she talked about a healing session she did with him where they did a past life regression. And what he remembered is that he had a life where he was on one of these, you know, how throughout the history of mankind in the Navy, a lot of times military experience is not one that is a warm invitation. It's one where you are drafted, you are pulled into it violently, you are simply abducted and absconded into. And he was in some point in time where he was in the Navy and he was on a ship, and it was one of these kind of slave ships. And whenever somebody wasn't rowing fast enough or hard enough, or if they tried to escape, his job was to cut off one of their feet because they could still continue to row without feet. And he wanted to come back in this life and experience that grief.
Yes. One can understand that perfectly, I think. I'd like to move on to something else that I think you'll have some opinion on, and that is about the ego and the place it has in our life.
Ooh, Mike, you know me so well. That's one of my favorite topics. Emmanuel Swedenborg, my boyfriend. Yes, how did you know, you psychic man, you?
Right.
In my book, what I wanted to do is something that it seemed to me was a great need for, but has rarely been ventured into. And that is this. I wanted to use consciousness to examine itself. And the reason that I wanted to use consciousness to examine itself is because consciousness is unlimited and is therefore the only instrument that is useful to examine consciousness with. And what I wanted to do is take the Eastern speak out of Vedantic psychology and Ayurvedic psychology and Taoism and Buddhist psychology, because they have very clear languaging about understanding the nature of consciousness itself. And I make a very big point of this in the first part of my book, in the chapter about two bodies, two minds, to really do a forensic breakdown on consciousness, the anatomy of consciousness, if you will. And what I point out is that we don't have love. Again, we don't have it. It's not a possession. Nobody can take it away from us. We don't have it. We are it. And that love consciousness that we are is our spiritual identity. And we bring it with us when we come to the planet Earth to experience ourselves and learn more about our value and power and worth. But because our true nature is love consciousness, that means there's absolutely nothing limited or minute or reductionist about what we really, really are. When we come to the planet Earth, we inherit a physical body from our physical parents, so we have a physical vehicle for interacting and moving around a physical world. When we come into the physical world to answer these questions, who am I? Why am I here? What is my value, my power, my worth? We also inherit a myriad of teeny tiny temporal problems in a teeny tiny temporal world. You're going to have to figure out what to wear. What clothing are you going to wear? You're going to have to figure out what day you pay your taxes. You're going to have to figure out how to feed yourself. You're going to have to figure out how to drive, when to put gas in your car, when to pick up your children from school. There are a myriad of these limited, tiny problems. You're going to have temporal problems in the temporal world that you are going to have to solve. Because you are love, and you are eternal, and you are unlimited, you don't have anything that small to answer those questions. You don't have a form of consciousness small and minute enough to make a 3-minute egg. So when we come here and inherit our physical body from our physical parents, so we have a physical vehicle for interacting in the physical world, we also inherit a second form of limited consciousness for solving limited problems in a limited world. And that is what we in the West refer to as the ego. So the ego is for solving problems like, is this milk too old? Should I throw it out? Should I use it in my coffee? How do I balance my checkbook? Do I need to change the oil in my car? Yeah. Your ego is not designed to answer questions like, who am I? Why am I here? What's my value, my power, my worth? Only your love consciousness can answer that. Only your spiritual identity can answer that, because it's the only consciousness big enough to answer that. So the ego is a limited form of consciousness, and the way that you can tell if your ego is talking to you versus your spiritual identity is that any time you hear a voice say something in your head that sounds limiting, feels limiting, tastes limiting, I don't know if I can do this, I don't know if this is going to work out for me, maybe there's something I'm not aware of that's going to completely take me out of this situation and I'm going to get blindsided. Any kind of narrative that smacks of limitation, that is the ego. And any voice or narrative that is outside of limitation is your spiritual identity. And I can prove, Mike, I can prove to everyone who's listening that they have two different forms of consciousness, because it's universal. And the way that I normally bring this to people's attention is this. How many times in your life were you presented with a problem and you, in considering that problem, suddenly knew the answer? You just knew it, because love is a feeling knowing. And you just knew the answer. You couldn't point on a schematic. You couldn't point on a blueprint where you knew that X turned into Y and this was that. There was no way in the flow of it that you could say how you knew it. You just knew it. And you had this knowing, and the thing came to pass, and you ran around and went, who be to spirit? Who be to spirit? I knew it was going to come out this way. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. And how many times were you presented a problem, and you had that knowingness? You knew what the answer was, and then the ego stepped in and started saying, ps, 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 what about this? Ps, 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 what about that? And the ego starts contaminating your feeling knowing, and you vacillate, and you shift over to the ego's story, and then the thing comes to pass, and you smack yourself on the forehead, and you say, why did I do this? I knew it was going to come out differently. I knew it. This is how I can prove we all have two forms of consciousness, because that experience I just described is universal to every single person on the planet because they have two forms of consciousness. One is their spiritual identity, and the other is the ego.
Right. That's excellent. Obviously, during our conversation, you've covered quite a few aspects of your book. It's been a terrifically interesting interview, and because it's so interesting, I haven't noticed the time flying by. We're getting near the end of the 55 minutes that I'm allocated, and I'd like to give you the opportunity to tell people briefly perhaps about your workshops, which I believe covers one related to self-emergence, whether you do seminars. Tell people where they can buy your book, and you'll need to give them your website address, I guess. And if you sell CDs, so the platform is yours.
You are such a gracious man, my love. Thank you so much, sweetheart. My website is purple, because as we've established, I have a thing for that color. Purple V. V is in vivacious. V is in vixen. V is in very. V is in Vaishali. I know it sounds like it starts with a W. It's a Sanskrit name. It's actually spelled with a V. Go to purplev.com. Or if you like typing in more letters, you can go to youarewhatyoulove.com. But youarewhatyoulove.com, purple V will take you to the same place. And there you can learn more about my book. You can even download the first chapter and read it and see if my voice resonates for you. You can learn about my companion playbook, which is the You Are What You Love playbook, because enlightenment should be lightening up. Most people really need a stickectomy. And the playbook allows you to give yourself a stickectomy and get everything that is rigid and serious and joy dampening out of your life. And I take the ideas in You Are What You Love, the main text, and in the playbook, I offer very creative ways to start adding more joy and more playfulness to your life. I also have a section in there about dreams and dream work. So if you do lucid or non-lucid dream work, you have a way to improve your dream life. I also have the You Are What You Love book on CD, which I recorded in my own voice. So you have a sense of taking the wild child with you. And I encourage people to get the book on CD and listen to that several times and let some of these ideas that you are what you love and you love whatever you give your attention to and you cannot create a learning experience that you did not need, let them become familiar and then go to the book where your mind will be created into a more fertile ground for these ideas to really take hold in your psyche. I also do individual sessions with people. And Mike, one of my fortes as an intuitive is dream interpretation. And I work with people on understanding what their individual life purpose is, in understanding what the obstacles to fulfilling their life purpose is, how to accelerate growth in the area of their life purpose. And if people have a dream, a reoccurring dream, a nightmare, or just something that they felt was prophetic or important dream and they want to know how to interpret it, what it means. These are all my fortes. These are all reasons why Divine Love and Wisdom found it appropriate to put my goofy butt on the planet, was to help you with these things. So my self-emergent sessions, and I call them self-emergence, because the idea is that we want to strip away the baggage that you came here to grow beyond and let your true self emerge. Those are available on the website. And you are welcome to email me at any time at V as in vivacious, V at purple V, if you would like more information about any of the above. So you can order my book, the playbook, the book on CD from my website, purplev.com or amazon.com.
That's great. Do you do any CDs at all?
I do have the book on CD, the You Are What You Love book. It's a condensed version because the book is almost 400 pages, and you can only get 88 minutes worth of data on a CD. So I extracted what I thought was the heart of You Are What You Love and put it on the book on CD.
That's great. I can't imagine how you found all the time to write such a long book. It's amazing.
Well, actually, the second time I was diagnosed terminal, I was diagnosed terminal twice, so there's very little about healing and pain and suffering. I failed to understand. Writing this book was part of my therapy.
Oh, I see. Oh, it served a sort of dual purpose then. That's great. We haven't quite come to the end of the program. Is there any final message you would like to give to our listeners?
Well, first what I'd like to do, sweetheart, is I'd like to acknowledge you, sweetheart, for what a lovely job you do of bringing this kind of consciousness to your listeners, and what a gracious and wonderful host you are to facilitate this kind of communication. So hugs and kisses and lots of purple pulsating love to you, my darling.
Wonderful. Well, I enjoy it. And we're in good company in as much that these are all subjects that I love to read about. So I can talk with you about it and understand what you're saying, and I admire what you're doing. I think it's a wonderful job.
Thank you, darling. I find the one thing that people cannot hear enough is you don't have love. You are love. Whether you're divorced, whether you're not divorced, whether you're employed, whether you're not employed, whether you've gone through bankruptcy or not gone through bankruptcy, whether you're diagnosed as terminal or not, you don't have love. You are love, and nothing in the temporal world has the power to take that away from you. You can disenfranchise yourself from it, but choose not to do this in that. Choose not to do that in this life.
Thank you. And that's a very beautiful message to end the interview on. I need the last minute just to tell people who I've got coming along last week. So thank you very much for appearing on my program. You're obviously a very seasoned speaker, and I know you have spoken many times nationally, and I think that comes through very well. You certainly know your subject, so thank you very much. Maybe in the near future we might look at you again and find out how you've been getting on and hear a bit more about your book.
I would adore that,
you.
Mike. Know that you always you always have an invitation to marry me and have my babies.
If I'm not too old, yes.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, listeners, I thought that was a wonderful interview. I'll just quickly say that my guest next week will be Dr. Matthew B. James. He's an expert on the Huna wisdom, and he uses it for modern applications. And he says, Huna is the healing and spiritual shamanism of ancient Hawaii. And it's going to be of interest to you if you are interested in spiritual growth and personal empowerment or expansion of your awareness and your connection to the universal spirit. There's something a bit different. Thank you for being with me today. I hope you'll be with me next week. Bless you all, dear friends.